Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilde Gottlieb, author of the Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, where our mission is to make visionary community change practical and doable. It is my privilege to host this podcast, where we talk with change leaders from around the world about this sector's potential for creating visionary social change. I'm so pleased to have Rich Harwood as my guest today on Making Change. For over 20 years, Rich and his staff have been engaging citizens in complex and controversial public issues through the Harwood Institute for Public Innovation. Rich is the author of several books, including Make Hope Real and his latest, the upcoming Why We're Here. Rich has become known as a leading authority on improving America's communities, and so it is my pleasure to have him share his observations with us today here on Making Change. My guest today on Making Change is Rich Harwood. Rich is president of the Harwood Institute for Public Innovation. It is great to have you with us today, Rich.
It's good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell the folks that are listening a little bit about the path that brought you to the work that you're doing?
Well, you know, I always thought when I was growing up, I grew up in a very active house. My parents were active. My father helped protect folks whose homes were being bulldozed through urban renewal. My mom helped start a halfway house with mental health patients were being institutionalized, deinstitutionalized in New York State. And I always thought that I'd be involved in politics. And so starting in junior high school, I started to help run a state assembly race and then worked on 20 political campaigns from junior high school all the way through graduate school. And then my last race, my 20th race, was a U.S. presidential race where I was the young aide to all the senior folks in the national office. And by the time I finished with those 20 races, by the time I had gone to Princeton for graduate school, by the time I had worked for a couple of nonprofits, I began to think, you know, that this path I was on wasn't going to enable me to live out my mission in life, to live out the values that I thought were important, which was to bring people together, to figure out how we can repair breaches in society, to figure out how we can transform the very conditions that make up our lives so that every single individual can get a fair shot at the American dream. And both in those campaigns, you know, they were about dividing people, about pushing people into corners. They were about striking fear into people. At Princeton, when I would raise questions about communities, I was told that those questions weren't relevant to the courses I was in, and yet this was in public policy and public affairs. When I worked for nonprofits and we went to low-income communities in West Virginia, for instance, my colleagues from New York City said they didn't like going to West Virginia because the people there smelled, they were dirty, quote unquote, they drove beat up cars. And yet, in saying all those things, they were describing the very people who coached me as I was growing up in sports, the people who mentored me and taught me beyond my parents about my values and what life was all about. So all of those things added up to me saying when I was 23 years old, when I was sitting outside the chairman of the Mondale for President campaign, I started doodling on a piece of paper and designing what became the Harwood Institute for Public Innovation 4 years later, and which I've been working at now for over 20 years.
Wow. Wow. What a transformation you had to go through in terms of just realizing that what you thought was going to work, it really wasn't going to. It was just doing the opposite. And so I'm curious, as you've watched over the past 20-some-odd years, when you see change happening in communities, what do you see undergirding that, especially that whole piece about bringing people together and the values that are at the core of what you're doing? What do you see undergirding change when you see it happening?
Well, you know, what I'd like to say is I see people turning outward toward one another. It's an orientation, a posture. It's not a best practice. I think one of the things that I keep finding as I do this work, you know, we can have all the best practices and techniques in the world, but if our orientation is still inward, whether it's inward toward ourselves or, as importantly, in a lot of the work that we do, where organizations themselves have taken on a kind of inwardness, where everything is self-referential, it's about their own survival, it's about their next strategic plan, it's about whether or not they can design a better logo with a better color that, quote-unquote, is more friendly. And what I think folks and organizations and leaders and citizens have forgotten is that we can make ourselves more attractive, but it doesn't necessarily make us more relevant or effective. And so first and foremost for me, what it is that we need to turn outward. Our orientation, our posture, our stance needs to change first and foremost. Then I think we can get into things like innovation and all sorts of other things. And the thing I would actually like to say that I always see present in change is faith, a sense of hope, a sense of what I would in my work call authentic hope as opposed to false hope. There's a sense that we can believe in ourselves, that something is possible, a sense that it's okay to believe in one another, a sense that through small steps we can restore our belief in the possibility for something positive or constructive to happen, a sense that through the stories we tell one another we can start to see ourselves and hear ourselves in those stories and in a sense implicate ourselves, that we are part of something larger than just ourselves. And I've never seen any change happen, real change, meaningful change, where there hasn't been a modicum of faith. You know, I did a lot of work in Flint, Michigan for years, at the height of it being beat up by GM pulling out and Delco and all sorts of other companies in the auto industry leaving, tens of thousands of jobs leaving, poor race relations, a lot of racism, a handful of people really controlling the decisions in the town for many, many years. But what I saw in the people there, folks who live there, folks who are leading organizations, faith-based leaders, was this kind of resilient faith that reminded me actually of the coach I was just mentioning a moment ago, who the folks, my colleagues from New York City, were down on because they may have smelled or run a beat-up car or something. And the folks in Flint or in Newark or in Las Vegas or Phoenix, Arizona, or wherever it may be, the folks where I've seen change happen, they have a kind of resilient faith that is just inspiring and also real and practical.
Tell me a little bit more about the practical part.
The practical part is, you know, I think once we turn outward, one of the things that we need to shift into, you know, planning is vitally important in everything we do. But a lot of times we can plan ourselves to death in a way. We can just keep going in circles. And what I've found about the practical part of the resiliency is a hunger to, they wouldn't necessarily use the word innovate, but it's innovation. They're innovating. They're trying things. They're stepping forward. They're piecing things together. They're figuring out where the lever is to create the change that they desire. They're thinking there's almost what I would call a ruthlessly strategic kind of orientation, that there are choices to be made. We can't do everything. And so we've got to figure out where it is we think we can have an impact, what will really make a difference in our lives, what is really relevant to what we need to do. And then in addition to all that, there's kind of like a trial and error of, let me try something over here and see if it works. It doesn't work. Let me sort of fool around with it a little and see if I can change it a bit and see if it'll work better if I sort of change it by 45 degrees or if I turn it on its head and try it again in a different way. And over and over and over again, I've seen people do this. And, you know, it doesn't create the big bang kind of change that we often hear about and like to talk about. But I think if you go way back to the American Revolution, this country was founded on innovation. Small bands of people, like-minded folks getting together, civil rights movement, the same thing, women's suffrage, the same thing, child labor laws, the same thing, where small groups of people got together and started to do stuff. They didn't have a grand scheme when they started.
Right.
They tried to create a trajectory, and in that trajectory, they needed faith to keep going when they kept getting knocked down and pushed over and told it wouldn't work.
You know, I'm fascinated as you're talking because it really does all root back to what you call faith, the belief in ourselves and the belief especially in each other. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what you mean by turning outward. What does it look like when an organization is turning outward rather than focusing inward?
Sure.
Because it sounds to me like that's almost a lack of belief in the other.
It is. And in fact, that's a great point. One of the things that even when we start working with people and they want to turn outward, the thing that prevents them from doing it, you know, they have their boards and procedures and all that kind of stuff that often stops them. But the real showstopper is fear.
Fear of?
It's fear of the unknown. Fear, this goes to your point of a lack of belief in a sense. They wouldn't necessarily say they have a lack of belief, but they don't have a strong belief that people will be reasonable. They don't have a strong belief that people can be for something as opposed to just against something. They don't have the belief that people can come together and amid our emotions And I believe deeply that we have to demonstrate and show, reveal our emotions in public life, because the things we care about, we're emotional about. And so many people who work in public life say, no, you got to be rational. You got to put those emotions, check them at the door. Don't get too emotional when we're talking about this. Well, if you're talking to a mom about her two kids are getting inadequate public education down the street, and it's not even safe for them to walk to that school when it's dark out, when they're coming, you know, either in the morning or when they're coming home, you better damn well believe she's going to be emotional about that, right? So when they have all these fears, or that people won't get together and work together for something called the common good, not just their own good, it stops them in their tracks. So what happens for an organization that starts to turn outward? For me, some of the markings are, first and foremost, they would engage the community to understand the things that matter to people, the things that people, not just their concerns and their problems, but their aspirations, which maybe we can get into, but they're different than dreams or visions. Because, you know, your aspirations are rooted in your gut. You don't need a consultant following you around town to remind you of your aspirations, like those visioning reports that everyone does that gather dust on the shelf. So we're pegging our work towards people's aspirations because we need to know what we're for, what trajectory we want to get on. They understand the concerns that people held, the real concerns, and the ways in which people articulate them, not the ways in which experts talk about them only, or the ways in which our budgets are constructed because we use one of these budget categories, or the ways in which the Brookings Institution tells you to frame an issue. All of those things are important. I don't mean to diminish them, but they're not enough. They're not enough. So we talk about the need to combine expert knowledge like Brookings and public knowledge, those things that only the community itself can generate by itself. We need to know about the conditions of the community. How much capacity does it have? What can we build on? You know, one of the things we keep finding is we keep designing strategies that actually don't fit where our community is, let alone the things that people are concerned about and their aspirations. So one of the things is we'd know our community much better. A second thing is I think if you're turned outward, you'd think about impact differently, not just about running programs or delivering services, both of which are important, but we'd think about something I call a sweet spot of public life, which is how do we move the needle on those things that matter to us and do it in a way that actually builds the capacity of the community at the same time? So that we're leveraging all our resources, all our hopes, all our wisdom, all our gifts, you know, all our money, frankly, because there's a scarcity of it and we can't afford to be fooling around. If we were turned outward, we'd have more boundary-spanning groups and organizations that bring people together across dividing lines, that know how to incubate ideas and things, but not hold on to them. Spin them off. Let someone else use them. We would be developing, I hate the word leaders, because it has such connotations in our society. So we use the phrase public innovators, because anyone can be a public innovator. Doesn't go by title, doesn't go by education. The best public innovators I've met oftentimes never, they may not have graduated from high school.
Right.
But they know something deeply about their community. Again, I'm talking about my coach, the person who mentored me all through my childhood, a guy named Ray Rivers. So we'd be cultivating public innovators who are turned outward, who have a sensibility of innovation, who know how to bring people together, who know that you can't just claim credit for things you didn't do and that you always need to share credit with whatever positive you did because you probably couldn't do it by yourself anyway, and who know how to tell stories, so that we can see and hear ourselves back in public life.
Well, speaking of stories, share one. Tell me what you've seen as you've been looking at this.
So one of the things that we've been doing is, you know, as you mentioned, we've been doing this work for over 20 years, and a few years ago we decided to flip our approach and figure out how we could scale our work much faster. One of the things that we did along those lines was to form alliances with nationally networked groups like United Way Worldwide, Public Broadcasting, AARP. So one of the stories I want to tell you about is KMPR in Las Vegas, public radio station that we were working with. Already had great people before we ever started working with them. That's important to say. But what they found as they started to know their community better, to think about impact differently, is their public affairs program, you know, the two-hour program that a lot of public radio programs have, was geared around issues, national issues that were localized and were run by a terrific guy, a host, who was a policy maven. And so those shows were largely framed, and I was on them often, those before we started working together, but those shows were framed around policy issues, getting the experts on, once in a while getting someone like me on to sort of mix it up a bit, you know, someone like yourself. But nonetheless, they were framed that way. What they realized as they started to look out into their community, to turn outward, was that people in Las Vegas had a deep desire to reconnect with one another. So all the stories about Vegas being this place where people just went to pursue the American dream for the second time, all true in some level, because only 3% of people there are natives, but they had too much of a good thing. And the tide had turned, and people started to say, we need to connect with one another. We don't know one another. We lived in the same neighborhood for 15 years. They've never seen their neighbor.
Wow.
Right? Part of that's because of shifts and everything at the casinos, but nonetheless, they hadn't known their neighbor. And they didn't feel the capacity to do it either. They didn't have a belief in one another. So here's some things that the station did. One, they pulled down that program, an award-winning program, and they revamped it to focus on local issues. The first thing they started was borrow a cup of sugar from your neighbor.
Mm.
And it was sort of kind of a joke, a tongue-in-cheek thing, but it actually launched them into a lot of things that they did do that took them all the way through the foreclosure crisis. And that program is now doing well. And in fact, they didn't go far enough, they told me. So recently I just learned that they replaced that anchor with someone else who had an even deeper community sensibility, because they wanted to go even deeper into the community issues and illuminate them in a way that people could think about them. But they didn't stop there. They had a website that was primarily a promotional tool for the station.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did is they turned it into a community portal, because they realized that what they needed to do was they needed to help people in the community not only connect to one another and also to connect to other groups in the community that were already doing good things, which when you think about it, is a strange thing for an organization to do, because most organizations I work with want to own all those contacts. They don't want to share them with other groups, right? But they did it. They did it. The third thing they did is they had a set of nonprofits that they were highlighting that were doing good work, that were largely contributing to the station in different ways.
Right.
They started to use with those groups our work. In that network, those groups came back to the station and said, you know what, you shouldn't be highlighting us. You should only be highlighting groups that are dealing with the issues you're covering in your program and showing how people can connect with them so that they can do their own, create their own pathways in the community. You should take some of us off the air.
Wow.
And not only that, but they formed a network together that's now connected with other groups we've worked with in Vegas that are trying to work together to create a tipping point, which we think is working, about how public life is conducted in that region. So that's just one really small example. We've got a new book coming out next month called Why We're Here, which is a collection of these stories about how did these public broadcasters turn outward, become more relevant to communities. And if I can, I just want to tell you the kicker of this. When we started this work with public broadcasters, everyone told me, A, it wouldn't work, and B, no one would be able to raise money around it. And right after we launched, we hit the Great Recession.
Right.
And at that point, a lot of the public broadcasters that we weren't working with were saying, well, the answer to that is we've got to rejigger our pledge drives and come up with better tote bags and DVDs to give away. The stations, the dozen stations we worked with during the Great Recession, their audience for their programs all went up. Their pledge drives, not all of them, but most of them went up. Their grants from foundations, Maryland Public Television got a $1 million innovation grant around this community work, because people believe so deeply in it. The number of partners who are now coming to the station to say, you're an asset in this community, we should be working together, all went through the roof.
Wow.
And their off-air work, which I think is as important, if not more important, the ways in which they bring people together, the ways in which they convene people to marshal the resources of the community, all of that work went up, and it doesn't cost them a dime to do.
Wow. What you're really talking about is, and public broadcast is a perfect example, because they really have been for so long in the tote bag and mug and DVD set mentality. They just exemplify what happens on a smaller scale with other organizations. They're just so out there about it. But what you're really talking about is moving from transactional relationships to trust relationships.
That's right. And to see that, in fact, and I know you've worked on this a lot, to see that you're in relationship with people.
Yes.
You know, so often we ask people to draw, after we've worked for them for a little bit, draw a picture about all their the organization's aspirations in the community and sort of their relationship to others in the community. And inevitably, those pictures always show them at the center of the community with spokes coming off them. You know, we've all seen these pictures. Some of us have drawn these pictures for our organizations.
Right.
And hopefully we've been reformed or something. But as they do this work, what they realize is one of the central questions they need to ask themselves, examine for themselves, and start to think about and ultimately answer is, what space do we occupy in the community? And to do that, there are two prerequisites. One, a sense of courage, that you're willing to actually be visible and be seen for who you are and what you do, and to put a stake in the ground and say, I may not know exactly the answer, I may not even be close yet, but I know I've got to put a stake in the ground because I've got to commit myself to something. But the other part that's equally important, I think more important, is a sense of humility, a belief that whatever it is you're going to do, you can only do with others, that the change that you're talking about is transformational change that the community owns. You're a part of it. You may be a catalyst for it. You may be a connector within it, but it's not yours. You don't own it.
Yeah.
And that you certainly don't have all the answers, and that you need others to be with you on that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. When I talk with groups, I share with them that I can prove to them that no matter how much they think they are about the community, that they are inwardly focused. And I can prove it with one line.
Okay.
And I tell them, when we talk as organizations about the integration and engagement of community, we talk about going out to the community,
right,
as if we're in here and they're out there. And that's really what you're talking about
is.
There are no lines, and when we start to see that there are no lines and that we are interdependent and interconnected and that none of us can do this on our own, then things start to change pretty quickly. I'm curious, in the time that we have left, I do have another question. I may just make this go longer because I'm enjoying it too much. You mentioned that you're doing some work with United Way.
Mm-hmm.
The question that I have as I'm listening is that much of the constraint that organizations feel is put upon them, they feel exactly that it is put upon them. In our experience, we have found, I'll share a very quick story. We were the founders, my business partner and I, Dimitri, we were the founders of the first diaper bank in the country, and that was here in Tucson, Arizona. When we went to see if the model we had developed could work elsewhere, we went up the road to Phoenix to put together the diaper bank up there and to engage folks in building their own diaper bank, to engage the community in building its own diaper bank. The model that we developed in Tucson was highly collaborative at the core. And what we were told consistently, it gets back to your belief systems, what we were told consistently, and especially by funders, that the organizations would never work together. And what resulted was that for 2 years, 50 people within organizations worked together to build the diaper bank in Phoenix. The thing that we find over and over again is that organizations do want to work together, and that part of the constraint that they're feeling and this sense of competition and this sense that we can't share is imposed by funders that require that they compete with each other. I had this conversation with Kathleen Enright when she was on the show several months ago. When you're working with United Way and some of the work that you may have done with other funders, what are you finding in terms of their belief system about changing that competitive nature?
Yeah. Well, you know, we've done studies of funders, of boards, and quote-unquote metric systems. You know, these are all sort of self-imposed or externally imposed belief systems, ways of doing business, that no matter how, you know, even when people want to break out of them, they have a hard time doing so. And for a lot of organizations, what we say is, look, you have to change the conversation with your funder. You have to get your funder thinking about, well, what are their aspirations in this work? And what will it actually take to move toward those? And what conditions do we actually need to create in the community to move toward those? And to help them see that it is only by you working with other groups that you'll be able to achieve that. Now, that said, what I will also say is when we're working with groups like United Ways, is I ask them this fundamental question, who do you want to run with? And a lot of these groups, United Ways, community foundations, all sorts of groups and communities, have entangled themselves in legacy relationships and other relationships because of the title of the group, the perceived credibility of the group, because that's just the way business has always been done. And they're afraid to break loose from those relationships. And what I say to them is, the extent to which you're afraid to break loose from those relationships is the extent to which you will not achieve what you're trying to achieve. And you face a fundamental choice. I know in your work you talk about choices a lot. In our work we talk a lot about intentionality, which is, I hope, something we can talk about. But you have to be intentional in the choices you're making. And you own those choices. You can say your funders control them. You can say your donors control them. You can say your mother controls them. But at the end of the day, you have something to say about them. And you can, if you don't control them, you can influence a lot of them. And my question for groups that are doing work in communities is, to what extent are you willing to step up to the line, grab hold of those choices, and make them your own, and do something?
Which comes right back to that whole sense that they're part of something bigger, and not that, well, no one will listen to me, it's just me, when they have that sense that they're part of something bigger, and the belief system is that they can believe in others, trust in others, and share stories with others. It is almost like magic the way it works.
It is. You know, I'm sure you've experienced this, and many people who will listen to this show will have experienced this. When people turn outward, and as you were talking a moment ago about going into the community, it's amazing to me that when we help people create these what we call community conversations, which are fairly deep conversations, and whenever someone participates one or listens in on one, their sense of what's possible, I don't mean changing the world, I just mean doing something in their community that can make an impact, that other people will step forward with them, that notwithstanding the real differences that exist in our mm-hmm. society and the fact that there's such a thing as evil, there's a hell of a lot of goodness, innate goodness in us. It's waiting to be tapped, and it's possible to tap it, and you don't need to go through some incredible process to do it. And when people begin to see that and they light up, and it's not this sort of like
right.
fake idealism, it's something deep within themselves that's being rediscovered.
Right.
No one gave it to them. They already had it. And at that moment, it doesn't mean you can create change. It just means that you can turn in a different direction. You can place yourself, hopefully, on a different trajectory, and you can grab hold of some other people or join in with some other people who believe, like you do, that something is possible, and then you got something going.
I'm so grateful that you could spend some time with us today, Rich. I feel like we're just getting started and could talk for another couple of hours, but I so appreciate it. I've scribbled down on a notepad the words that you just shared about rediscovering what's real and possible within us so that we can see that in others, and I just appreciate that so much. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Speaking with Rich, one quickly gets a sense of what authentic engagement might look and feel like. We quickly see that it's not just possible for people to work together for our collective good, that whether or not we believe it, people do put the needs of others before their own needs. They do it all the time, and happily. I loved Rich's story about the public broadcast station, where organizations actually asked the station to stop highlighting them, as there were other organizations that were more appropriate to the work at hand. When we picture integrity and authenticity, that's the kind of thing we picture. Most importantly, it is a real story of real people putting the collective good before their own well-being. And I'm quite sure if we had had time, Rich could have shared dozens of stories just like that one. It's not the exception. It happens consistently when people are given the opportunity to create something bigger than themselves. Which leads to Rich's focus on belief systems as a prerequisite to an organization focusing outward rather than inward. I appreciated his sharing the importance of organizations believing others will be reasonable, because our expectations really do become our reality. If we believe other organizations will only look out for their own self-interest, that's how we will engage with them. On the other hand, if we believe that organizations will happily work together towards the common good, then that's how we will engage with them. This raises many questions for the way organizations and social enterprises currently do their work. To what extent do we assume that others will compete with us or steal our ideas instead of working with us on those ideas? How do our beliefs create our reality? If we changed our assumptions, is it possible we would focus more outwardly than internally? And what role can funders play in changing their own assumptions to encourage community leaders to build trust relationships rather than transactional relationships? If you're interested in exploring these questions, please join us at the Chronicle of Philanthropy's group at LinkedIn. If you're not already a member at LinkedIn or of the group, please sign up and join us. The conversations generated by these podcasts are always lively. And you can always find great ways to connect, as well as other terrific information, at the Chronicle's website, philanthropy.com, or follow the Chronicle on Twitter @philanthropy. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me on Twitter, I'm @HildeGottlieb, or at our website, creatingthefuture.org. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a better future for your community and our world. For the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hilde Gottlieb. We'll see you the second Thursday of next month here on Making Change.